on this edition for Sunday, June 13th. The Biden administration says America is back as the G7 summit wraps, and the president prepares for NATO and a later meeting with Vladimir Putin. A new Israeli government dislodges Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after 12 years in office. And the annual Tribeca Film Festival celebrates 20 years and getting back on track after an unconventional year. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. President Joe Biden said today that America is back at the table and leading the world alongside nations that share democratic values. At a news conference following the final session of the G7 summit, the president said the G7 leaders agreed to provide 1 billion doses of COVID vaccines to the rest of the world, with half of the supply coming from the U.S.
The U.S. Contribution is the foundation to work out how we're going to deal with the 100 nations that are poor and having trouble finding vaccines and having trouble dealing with reviving their economies if they were in the first place in good shape.
In a 25-page communique issued at the conclusion of the meeting, the G7 leaders agreed to consult with one another on what they called non-market economic policies from China. Also, they are, quote, calling on China to respect human rights and fundamental freedoms, especially in relation to Xinjiang, and those rights, freedoms, and high degree of autonomy for Hong Kong. During the meeting, the countries did not reach agreement on completely ending the use of coal, but Mr. Biden did say the other leaders noticed a significant change in the U.S. position on global warming.
Some of my colleagues said to me when I was there was, well, the United States' leadership recognizes there is global warming. And I know that sounds silly, but, we had a president who basically said it's not a problem, global warming. It is the existential problem facing humanity, and it's being treated that way.
On Wednesday, President Biden will meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Switzerland. During the conference, he was asked if he agrees with Putin's statement that the relationship between the two countries has deteriorated to its lowest point in recent years.
I think he's right. It's a low point. And it depends on how he responds to acting consistent with international norms, which in many cases he has not.
Before heading to Brussels and a NATO summit tomorrow, the President and First Lady Jill Biden met with Britain's Queen Elizabeth. The private meeting followed a formal review of the Guard of Honor at Windsor Castle. NewsHour White House correspondent and Washington Week moderator Yamiche Alcindor is traveling with the president and joined us from Brussels. So Yamiche, the G7 did put out a communique, and yesterday you and I spoke about how the president was interested in getting strong language against China in there. Did he get what he wanted?
Well, there was this 25-page communique, and that is a stark difference from what happened when former President Trump came to the G7 in 2018. He famously left early, would not agree to a statement. So just the idea that this is kind of back to the standard G7 is something that we need to note. Other thing to note is that President Biden in a press conference later said that he was, quote, satisfied with the language on China. Past communiques had not mentioned China by name, from my understanding. And this time around, you have China being called out for using forced labor, also for using issues and efforts that were not market friendly here and traditional here. The other thing to note is that President Biden was really part of a group of leaders here who wanted to see China called out by name. So this is, I think, in some ways shows that President Biden got a bit of what he wanted. The other thing is that the communique talks about shared values. It talks about democracy. It talks about the need to do as much as possible to try to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, especially when it comes to these seven wealthy nations doing as much as they can to nations that are struggling and who are needy.
There are quite a few climate activists that are disappointed in what's not in there.
That's right. So there was a failure to really set a goal for the way to end the use of coal around the world. So there is, in some ways, some real feeling that they did not go far enough on that. That is seen as a failure. It's right up there with the idea that, yes, he did get what he wanted on China, but did not get what he wanted on climate change.
Yeah, he had a press conference, his first one of this trip. A lot of questions about what's coming up with him and President Vladimir Putin. What did he say?
Well, this press conference led to a lot of talk about Russia from President Biden. He said that he looked forward to really bluntly and firmly talking to Vladimir Putin one-on-one. President Putin has been out saying that he would be willing to give up some of these criminal gangs that have reportedly carried out these ransomware attacks and these hacks if the U.S. would exchange criminals that really broke the law when it came to Russia. And President Biden surprisingly said, yes, I would be open to that. The other thing to note, though, is that he said that there still needs to be a lot of human rights issues called out in Russia. But he also said that he wants to try to find some way to work together. He said Russia has a lot of its dilemmas, a lot of economic problems, a lot of pandemic related problems. So you can tell that he still wants to have that strong force with Russia, but also is really open to trying to have some sort of communication that might benefit the American people.
When President Trump went to this, and when he attended NATO, his interests were in NATO footing more of the bill. President Biden is not that different, and he also wants NATO to participate more. But what's different about how they carry themselves?
Almost every American president has come to NATO and said more of these countries need to spend more on defense. So when former President Obama went to NATO in 2014, there was an agreement to spend a certain percentage of countries' GDPs on defense. And as a result, you had President Trump really coming back and wanting to push for that. Experts told me that actually hurt and that you saw some European countries actually go less than 2% drop their defense because they didn't want to be seen as doing President Trump's bidding. Another big thing that's going to happen in NATO is they're going to be talking a lot about the state of democracy. January 6th is really seen as a security risk, not just to the United States, but around the world. So there's going to be a lot of talk about defense and the idea that democracies need to learn and need to show that they're functioning as a way to really push off autocracies. You hear the President Biden saying that a lot, democracies versus autocracies. He's saying that's going to be the defining thing of our generation, of the generations to come.
You know, in the conversations with Vladimir Putin, I'm assuming that the cyber hacks and the ransomware attacks are going to come in. But this is a large area that I'm assuming President Biden is also going to be dealing with, along with NATO and the European leaders.
That's right. Cybersecurity and emerging technologies is a big, big focus. You know, of course, there was the military aspect of that came together when you had NATO and after World War II. But now the battle is really a cyber battle. And we saw recently with the U.S. infrastructure being disrupted by ransomware attacks when it comes to meat producing and gas lines. So there is real issues about the success that these hackers have had. And I think there's now this talk President Biden might even be pushed to issue a sort of ultimatum to the Russian president. The president hasn't agreed to that, but you're hearing Democrats and Republicans saying they really want President Biden to get into that meeting with the Russian president and to talk to when he's talking to NATO and say, we're going to take a hard line on these ransomware attacks.
And finally, on a lighter note, it's usually tradition for the president or the dignitaries to visit the queen. So the president and the first lady visited. Any news on what happened there?
From what we can understand, this was a sort of traditional visit. There was no perch snatching of the queen. There was nothing that seemed cringeworthy as of yet. We've seen some other cringeworthy things. There was when former President Trump met the queen, he was criticized for turning his back on the queen at one point. From what we can tell, this was sort of a traditional meeting. The White House says that President Biden last had a meeting with the queen in November of 1982. So this actually wasn't his first time meeting the queen, but it seems as though everything went smoothly as of now.
All right. NewsHour's White House correspondent and moderator of Washington Week, Michelle Sindor, joining us from the UK. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Hari.
For the latest on the G7, President Biden's overseas trip, and the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. Israel's parliament approved a new government today, sending former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu into the opposition after a record 12 years in office. One of the leaders of a new coalition party, Naftali Bennett, is now prime minister. Bennett was continuously interrupted by loud heckling from Netanyahu's supporters as he addressed the Knesset ahead of the vote. The right-wing tech millionaire thanked Netanyahu for his years of service and promised that his new administration would reach across the aisle.
Our government will make an effort to deepen and nurture relations with our friends in both parties, bipartisan. If there are disputes, we will manage them with fundamental trust and mutual respect.
Bennett's coalition is the first to include an Arab minority party, along with left-wing and centrist legislators. Netanyahu used his speech to defend his record and vowed to return to power.
If it is destined for us to be in the opposition, we will do it with our backs straight until we topple this dangerous government and return to lead the country in our way.
Netanyahu failed to form a government after an election on March 23rd, the fourth election in 2 years. For more on the new Israeli government, I spoke with National Public Radio correspondent Deb Amos, who is covering the events in Jerusalem today. Benjamin Netanyahu has been in power for quite some time. How did we get to this position where he's actually potentially out?
So it took a while, and it took 2 years and four inconclusive elections. He couldn't put together a coalition, even though he won 25% of the vote. This is a parliamentary system. And so that was his problem. And it went to how popular he really is. And he has been challenged, which I think is why it's so stinging for him, by men who were his political allies. Future prime minister, the one who the prime minister Naftali Bennett worked for Netanyahu, was fired by Netanyahu. There are two other party heads who broke off from him after he, you know, booted them out. So they're the ones who are taking him on. And Israelis are tired of the political paralysis. And there hasn't been a budget since 2019. And so, you know, post-COVID, post-Gulf War, these were issues that were divisive here. This coalition was, they were able to cobble together this very strange, gravity-defying coalition that is from the left, from the right. There is an Islamic Palestinian party for the first time ever. It's quite an amazing group of people.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the strange bedfellows here. I mean, on the one hand, Naftali Bennett, he has said previously that Israel should take over some of the lands. He thinks that Palestine would be as a state would be a bad idea. But at the same time, this coalition only has a majority of what, one vote?
Indeed. And so what you hear from analysts here is that they will stick to the stuff they agree on, mostly domestic policy. You know, Netanyahu set a standard for how you do these things. And one of the things that he was able to do over the 12 years that he's been in power was show Israelis that they could actually do okay without settling the Palestinian issue. And they have made not one single move towards trying to resolve it. And this coalition can last for a while without doing that either. And it's quite likely that they will not do it because they cannot do it, because they are so ideologically opposed to each other on the big issues. You know, they can agree, do we need another airport? Yeah. Can we have some more roads? That'd be good. What about a second hospital? Yeah, that's great. And for the first time, let's have quite a bit of money, a remarkable amount of money has been pledged to help Arab towns, you know, to beef up the police departments in those places, to make better schools, better roads. You know, let's see if that gets through the budget. But these are all domestic issues. And the big stuff, they can't agree on anyway.
Tell us a little bit about what happened today. I mean, I imagine that Benjamin Netanyahu is not the type to go quietly into the night, nor are his supporters.
Today, what you saw was members of parliament brought the fight to the floor of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Naftali Bennett was the first one to speak, and he couldn't do it. It was very clear that it was organized. There were Likud members who were shouting. There were other people from the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox parties who walked out. I mean, and shouting so loud that Naftali could not speak. It was supposed to be a 15-minute slot. It ended up being almost an hour. Eventually, there were ushers who escorted the loudest out of the chambers, but it was chaos in there. And finally, Bennett said something like, the strength of your screams reflects the strength of your failure. You know, he got into the fray as well. Then next up was Netanyahu, which was, you know, a flame-throwing speech. He essentially called Naftali Bennett a liar, a vote thief, a danger to the state of Israel, that he would be too weak to stand up to the Americans, to the Iranians, even to the Palestinians. And, you know, he essentially said, we will be back, and we will be back soon. You know, we're not going to shrink back and be quiet. This is not a presidential system like ours, where the president goes off to Texas and he's quiet. That's not how this works. So Netanyahu will remain the head of the opposition, and he will be as loud as he has been, as divisive as he has been. Now, there are some commentators here who say that is exactly what may keep this coalition together and keep them in their seats, because they have this guy who is right over their shoulders and will yell at them for everything they do, and it may keep them together. You know, if you don't hang together, you will hang alone.
NPR's Deborah Amos joining us from Jerusalem. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Last Wednesday marked the 20th anniversary of the annual New York City-based Tribeca Film Festival. It was the largest film fest held in person in North America since the start of the pandemic. This year's event, called Tribeca Festival, removing the word film to include multiple platforms such as gaming and podcasting, runs through next weekend. But opening day was all about the movies. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano spoke with the festival's producers about what it was like to plan this major event, and has more.
On Wednesday evening in New York City, the Tribeca Film Festival marked its 20th annual opening night at the United Palace Theater in Washington Heights. It premiered with the screen adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway musical, In the Heights.
It's so thrilling to be in New York as it starts to open back up again, as people start to feel safe to be in the movie theater. It's an honor to be part of the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm even more honored that they had the premiere uptown, so that this love letter to this neighborhood is premiering in the neighborhood it's about.
The film's release date was delayed last year due to the pandemic, but on Wednesday evening, for the first time ever, Tribeca screened its premiere movie outdoors in each of New York City's five boroughs as part of the 12-day festival that also includes shorts, TV series, podcasts, and games. Tribeca Film Fest producers Kara Cusimano and Lauren Hammonds believe In the Heights set just the right joyful tone on the heels of a traumatic year.
As we saw it and we saw people dancing and singing in the streets, we said, this is what we need. This is what we want for ourselves. So this is what we want for our audiences.
Finally being able to premiere that in front of an audience across all five boroughs is hugely symbolic. We know that a lot of people coming to the festival are seeing a film together on a big screen for maybe the first time in over a year. And that's a really meaningful return and moment.
Tribeca was first started as a direct result of 9/11. And that was the thinking of our founders, Jane Rosenthal and Robert De Niro at that time, to give art the opportunity to heal an audience. So I think this is a unique position that we find ourselves in during our 20th anniversary to do the same thing.
Last year, the in-person film festival was canceled due to the pandemic, yet organizers continued planning for 2021, reviewing a record number of 11,220 film submissions.
Even though people had these incredible limitations and hardships this year, more work was made and submitted than ever before. And that's just something that's incredibly exciting to see and really inspires me for the future of film.
Planning during a pandemic led to several innovations in the festival's programming, which organizers hope to carry into future festivals.
For people who have been to the Tribeca Film Festival before, how will this year look different?
Well, we are bringing almost everything outdoor. So that's a huge difference. And they're separated into pods. So you're in a two-person or a four-person pod that's socially distanced from the next pod. Although all of these amazing things are happening here in New York City, the festival is still available to you at home.
This year, almost all of the films in Tribeca's lineup are available online through the festival's virtual hub, Tribeca at Home. And there are new immersive installations, some virtual and some in person and outdoors, such as Current by Annie Saunders, which includes a sound walk through Lower Manhattan. Casey Baltus, vice president of Tribeca Games, says the pandemic also sparked a major expansion in the festival's online arcade and virtual reality platforms.
We have opened up a full lineup of games for official selections for the first time this year. And I think this year during the pandemic, many people who probably had never played video games before probably picked up a controller or probably tried that first game. And so that's the kind of experience that we also want to replicate at Tribeca.
As we were all stuck in our houses and looking for a way out, looking for something to transport us, these artists have worked tirelessly to create new worlds. For anyone who has a headset, a tethered headset at home, you can buy a ticket and see brand new experiences in the comfort of your own home with your own hardware. So it's really great that we're able to expand the audiences, not just through the five boroughs of the city, but also throughout the country. And we really hope that people will tune into the festival, even if they're unable to travel.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Klorfine Foundation, the Peter G. Peterson and Joan Gantz Cooney Fund, the estate of Worthington Mayo Smith. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.